A few weeks ago, I found myself in a conversation with a few other moms here at Chalice. Nothing planned, just one of those after-service chats that starts out light. But as we talked, we discovered that we had something deeply personal in common. We're all mom. You just have to bear with me. We're all moms to autistic children. In that moment, there was this unspoken understanding. The stories we didn't have to explain, the kinds of exhaustion that don't show up on your face, but it's deep in your bones, the fierce love. The advocacy, the worry, the constant dance between hope and heartache. There was something comforting in realizing we're not alone in this, which is what we feel most of the time. That conversation was the spark for this talk today. Because what we were really talking about, without even naming it, was something called neurodiversity. We were talking about what it means to live with a brain and a nervous system that processes the world differently. We were talking about occupying a space that, in many ways, is a minority position, one that's often invisible and misunderstood. And here's why I want to talk about it today. As Unitarian Universalists, we care deeply about justice. We've marched for civil rights, for LGBTQ+ rights, for climate justice. We stand up against the visible systems of oppression. And today, as a mother of a neurodivergent child, I invite us to also open our eyes to the injustices that are harder to see. Among us, right here in this room, are people who navigate daily injustice, not because of the color of their skin or whom they love, but because of how their brains process language, sound, emotion, connection. Because their rhythm doesn't match the one our world demands. Us moms, that day, with this unique path in common, were naming the ache, the wonder, the fierce love, and the loneliness we experience by often battling the systems on behalf of our children. So let me define neurodiversity because it's more than just a buzzword. Neurodiversity is the idea that there is no one right way for a brain to work. It's a term that originated in the autistic community and has grown into a much broader human rights movement. At its heart, neurodiversity challenges us to shift from a mindset of what's wrong to one that simply asks, what's different? It's a strength-based approach. Instead of pathologizing difference, it asks us, especially the 80% of us, who are considered neurotypical, to think differently, to see value in minds that move at different speeds, with different rhythms, patterns, and gifts. Neurodiversity is not about fixing people, it's about creating spaces where every brain and nervous system can thrive. Over time, the word neurodiversity has expanded to help us appreciate that there are neurodivergent and neurotypical brains. What began in the autistic community has grown to include a wide range of brain differences, each with its own strengths, challenges, and lived experiences. Let's take a look at this visual. It helps illustrate just how broad the neurodivergent spectrum, representing 20% of humans, really is. Around this circle, you'll see different ways of being in the world: ADHD, autism, learning differences like dyslexia, epilepsy, anxiety, mood disorders, and more. These aren't labels to fear or fix. They're real lived experiences that shape how people think, feel, move, and connect. Every single one of these represents a different kind of brain and nervous system, and each one asks us again to expand our definition of what it means to be human and what it means to belong. As you look at this chart, I invite you to reflect. How many of you can identify with one or more of these lived experiences, or know and love someone in your inner circle who does? Can I see a show of hands? This is what it means to be human. Neurodiversity is not out there. It's right here, in this room, in our families, in ourselves. And if this is your story, your lived experience, you already know what it means to live in a world that feels like it is not made for you. We often hear that autistic people struggle with social communication, but what if the problem isn't one-sided? There's a concept called the double empathy problem. It suggests that the breakdown in understanding doesn't stem from a lack of empathy or skill on one side, but from the challenge of two very different ways of experiencing the world trying to connect. Autistic people often communicate beautifully with one another. The difficulty arises in cross-neurology conversations between autistic people and neurotypical people, between neurodivergent people and neurotypical people, where each side is interpreting behavior, emotion, and language through an entirely different lens. It's not a failure of character. It's a mismatch of expectations. It's like a conversation between someone who's speaking French and someone who speaks Mandarin. Both are intelligent. Both are expressive. Both are eager to connect. But unless they learn one another's language, or at least try, they're going to miss each other. And when that happens again and again, something deeper begins to set in. That's what's known as dialectical misattunement, the idea that repeated misunderstanding can widen the gap between communication styles, reinforcing mistrust, frustration, and a sense of isolation on both sides. And here's the painful part. The burden to bridge that gap is almost always placed on autistic and more largely all neurodivergent people. They're expected to mask, to suppress their natural behaviors, to stop fidgeting, make eye contact, smile more, act normal. And they do, because they want to belong, they want to be accepted, they want to feel safe, and they want to be a part. But masking comes at a huge cost. It's exhausting, it's alienating, it leads to anxiety, depression, and even suicidality. Imagine filtering every gesture, every impulse, every word, just to be seen as acceptable. That's not belonging. That's surviving. And that brings us to something essential. The way we treat people shapes their development. This is the heart of the transactional model of development. When a child is misunderstood or misread, when they're treated like a problem that needs to be fixed, they start to see themselves that way as broken. But when they're met with curiosity and patience and love, they can bloom. That's why the social model of disability matters so much. It says maybe the problem isn't the person. Maybe it's the environment, the noise, the pressure, the unwritten rules. Maybe it's the way we've structured normal. And if that's the problem, then we have the power to change it. We have identified an injustice worth battling. As Unitarian Universalists, we are people of deep values. We say we side with love. We believe in human dignity. We believe in justice. And love, real love, asks something of us. It asks us to meet people where they are, to learn their language, to change systems that exclude, to build communities that embrace every kind of mind, not just because it's kind, but because it's right, because it's holy, because it's love in action. Now I gotta get the tissues out because I wanna tell you a story. Thank you, Wyona. It starts with a dream. The kind you carry into your late 30s when you decide finally that you're ready to become a mother. I was 38. My husband was 17 years older than me, and I had no idea that my age increased the odds of having an autistic child by 40% and his age by 75%. I didn't know how rare the pregnancy complication I developed was, which only 0.1% of pregnancies worldwide experience it, nor its link to autism. I didn't know how many nights I'd spend in the quiet ache of uncertainty. I didn't know the spiritual path ahead of me. What I did know was that after months of bed rest, 3 days of labor, and if anybody knows me, you know I don't rest well. 3 days of labor in an emergency C-section. I was wheeled out of the hospital holding a miracle we named Emma. No manual, just a nurse's kind smile and a good luck. All moms know that good luck. I remember thinking I needed a graduate degree to run a business, and all I needed was a car seat to be a mom. The years that followed were filled with beauty and bewilderment. Emma was brilliant, verbally precocious, curious about everything. But by 6, we were in therapies 4 days a week, occupational, cognitive behavioral, and play therapy, navigating diagnoses like sensory processing disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder. She clung to me at school drop-off, convinced that if she let me go, I might die and not come back to her. I was told, this is normal, she'll grow out of it. Then the seizures began. We found her in bed, unconscious, grand mal. I still see the blur of that night in slow motion, the 911. The 911 call, the paramedics, the gurney, the fluorescent hospital lights. I remember holding her hand in the scanner, promising it would be okay when I wasn't sure it would be. This began the years that I stopped sleeping, laying awake at night, making sure she was breathing, going into her room, checking and rechecking. What followed was a journey no parent imagines. Medication after medication, misdiagnoses, doctors saying she was faking it or I was making it up. One told us right in front of Emma that she'd be in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Hospital stays, an evaluation for brain surgery to try and make the seizure stop because eventually we couldn't get the medication to work. I became a warrior, not because I wanted to, but because I had no choice. I fought insurance companies, I tracked down specialists, I stood in rooms where no one believed what I knew was true. And when the seizures were finally controlled, the challenges didn't stop. Autism emerged as the next chapter. A new school surfaced all the symptoms that had been hidden by routine and safety, with mom being the PTA president at her elementary school. I got a phone call. Emma, 9 years old, had eloped from school. I didn't even know what that word meant. Wandering the neighborhood, lost, sobbing, found by a stranger. They brought her back to the school. So we adapted again. We moved her to a new school to stop the bullying, to find a place, any place, where her beautiful, different mind could be understood. But the system kept failing her. So we tried again and again, one school, then another. In the end, we spent $450,000 on private school tuition. One of the reasons I'll be working long past the age I once imagined retiring. And I'd do it again. Then came the pituitary tumor. One day, Emma looked at me and said, "Mom, there's white stuff leaking out of my breasts." More scans. More fear. More sitting in parking lots after appointments trying to hold it together. The tumor triggered a hormonal storm in her body, and adolescence, which was already hard enough, became a minefield of confusion and pain. And with that, our calendar filled again. Another IST added to the support team. With epileptologist, we added a neuroendocrinologist and a gender specialist. The path kept shifting, and we just kept walking it together. There were moments I felt like I was drowning in acronyms and appointments, IEPs, EEGs, MRIs, blood work, pharmacy runs, but underneath the logistics was the deeper truth. I was mothering a child whose body and brain moved through the world in ways few people understand, and even fewer knew how to support. And so I became not just a mother, but a translator, an advocate, a fighter. I stood between LOP, my kiddo's name today, who uses they-them pronouns, and a world that too often said they were too much, too sensitive, too emotional, too complex, where all they ever were was exactly themselves. This journey didn't come with a map, but it gave me something else. It gave me a lens, a way of seeing the unseen. And it has changed me. Being a LOPS mom has broken me open and rebuilt me into someone fiercer, softer, more patient, and more capable than I ever thought imaginable. It has stretched my capacity for love beyond what I thought possible. It has grounded me in advocacy, in radical acceptance, and in sacred resilience. It has made me more than a mother. It has made me a systems navigator, a medical translator, an education advocate, a night watch, and a fierce protector of one small sacred life. It has made me live with a foot in two worlds, the one we're given and the one I keep trying to build. A world where difference is not punished, but welcomed. Where children like mine are seen not as problems to solve, but as people to cherish. I carry a fire that doesn't go out because it was lit with love. And I know I am not alone. This path has been holy ground and also often so hard and so isolating, it's relentless. But here's the truth. Moms like me, we are everywhere. We're in your neighborhood, sitting next to you in services, at this service, smiling at coffee hour while holding worlds of worry inside. We carry binders and burnout, grace, and grit. We know what it is to advocate like a warrior and collapse in the car after crying alone. And we don't always tell you because it's hard, because it's vulnerable, because sometimes we're just too tired to explain. But when we find each other, like I did when those moms after service, that day, it's like oxygen. We exhale, we remember we're not alone, We don't have to translate our love. We just know. And that's what community is for. Not to fix it, but to witness, to hold space, and to walk with us. Because the truth is, this journey isn't just mine. It belongs to every parent navigating a world that wasn't built for their child. It belongs to every caregiver trying to decode the system. It belongs to every person who has felt the ache of not being missing and not being understood. And so today, I'm asking you, can we build a world that just doesn't tolerate difference, but celebrates it? Can we be the kind of community that sees the fierce love behind the tired eyes? Can we widen our circles, stretch our imaginations, and become a place where every soul belongs? Because I believe we can. Because I believe we must. On this Mother's Day, I want to take a moment to recognize and honor all the mothers in this room, all of you, and especially the warrior moms walking the sacred path with me. You are seen, you are loved, and you're not alone. May it be so. So I'm going to tell you one more thing before I end. My child is 23 years old. And in 23 years, my child never, unless the teacher made him make the card, you know, Happy Mother's Day card, my child doesn't pay attention to the fact it's Mother's Day. I was rushing out the door this morning, and I came into my living room, and my child was sitting at the dining table, and stuff sitting in front of them, and said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Chalice. I'm giving this service today." And his face drops, and I'm like, "What's wrong?" He got me a Mother's Day card and a present, and wanted to give it to me, and I celebrated that moment. Because it's just the little things, right? It's just the little things. I was so proud to open it. And one of the things that I've often said to my kid is when I bump up against and have a hard time, he hears me say, "I feel like I'm failing you." So he gave me this book this morning. And the title of the book was, "There Are Worse Moms Than You." I will cherish that book forever.